Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Hi. In today's episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast, our guest is Rania Masri, who is joining us from the front lines on the ground in Beirut. Rania Masri is an elected council member of the political party Citizens in a State. She is also an environmental scientist and lecturer at the Lebanese American University. Her writings have centered on the issues of ecological sustainability, environmental politics, and social movements. Rania has also written and organized extensively against the sanctions on Iraq and the occupation of Palestine, as well as civil and environmental rights. Rania, thank you so much for being with us, especially during this devastating time in Beirut. Thank goodness you're safe, whatever that even means these days, and hope that you continue to stay steadfast in these very, very difficult times.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to ask this outside of the world. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
So before delving into conversation, I'm going to provide listeners with a brief context of what has been happening as of late in Lebanon. A massive explosion shook Beirut on August 4th, 2020, and obliterated most of the Beirut port and swaths of the capital, killing more than 200, injuring 6,000, and dozens are still missing. The explosion caused extensive infrastructure damage, which has been estimated to over $15 billion and has left 300,000 people homeless, which is extremely concerning amidst a global health pandemic. Also in 2013, a ship carrying over 2,000 tons of ammonium nitrate on way to Mozambique stopped at the port of Beirut due to some kind of failure. There have been many questions about why the ship arrived to Beirut in the first place, why it was docked there and stored for 7 years with the knowledge and negligence of the political class there. The explosion has been the last straw in a protracted crisis over the collapse of the economy, rampant corruption, and the dysfunctional government that has thrived because of the sectarian political system in Lebanon. Preceding the blast, Lebanon was already met with a severe economic crisis and, of course, a political crisis. This explosion has fueled tremendous anger and has revitalized protests, many whom are trying to remove the entire political class from power and dismantle the system. However, some protesters have also used the disaster as a political opportunity to further Western imperialist agendas, things that I hope we can delve into our conversation today. So, Rania, before we get into our conversation, I also just want to ask you, where were you at the time of this blast?
You know, whenever I hear that question, because that's how we've been greeting each other this past week. Where were you? Thank God for your safety. What were you doing? I was in Beirut. I was in my home with a few friends, and I am a few kilometers away from the center of the explosion, but I was to the west of spread. So had there not been grain silos right in front of the explosion, then the damage to Beirut would have been so much greater. I would not be here speaking to you today. My apartment basically shook and the windows were, you know, pushed out of the walls, if you can imagine. Mm. But we were quite lucky, this part of the neighborhood. In another part of Beirut, several neighborhoods have been left completely devastated. I'm not exaggerating when I say there is not one store or shop, and five entire neighborhoods of Beirut that is left intact. Windows blown apart, walls crushed, doors blasted across the entire apartment, storefronts, building, and all of this happening in seconds, in seconds. And we keep hearing about stories of friends and, you know, who had left a particular minutes ago, and had they not left, they would all have been victims or were on their way to that particular area and not been delayed. They would also have been victims. So many of us feel now, Lebanon, more than ever, that we are alive by chance. We're alive solely by chance.
That is horrifying to hear. And there are no words. There are no words except for rage, because this could have been prevented. What are sentiments of the people on the ground at this time?
There's a great deal of outrage, a great deal of outrage. But, you know, the first few days of the explosion, I foolishly thought that this tragedy, this catastrophe, would move people out of their political lives. Those who still had hope in a particular sectarian leader would realize that that sectarian leader is just as negligent as all the others. But that's not what actually happens in trauma. It's not what happens. What happens when people are in shock, when people are outraged, when people are angry, is that we hold on to whatever narrative we had previously, and we hold on to it all the more. So the majority of people in the country, and I would, you know, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, have been these assessments. But yes, there is outrage in the streets. People are very angry. But I cannot say for certain if outrage acted at all the political sectarian leadership, because they're all responsible, or if the outrage is just directed against one or two individuals that you previously did not like for whatever political reasons. And I'm saying this because I think we really, really need to understand that we can look at this as a crime, trace the individuals responsible from the port authorities to the courts, to the arms, to the ministries, and they're all responsible. And this, it needs to be done with this tracing. But I think we also need to ask a very critical question. What kind of system allows this level of negligence, allows this level of indifference? What kind of a political system will allow for 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate to be improperly stored for more than 6.5 years?
I mean, to your point exactly, what kind of political system allows this level of negligence, that while knowing that this amount of ammonium nitrate could explode, choose to ignore it? So speaking of, you know, the system, can you explain what the sectarian political system in Lebanon looks like, and also perhaps provide some historical context on this sectarian system and how it has created an elite political ruling class in the country?
When we think about Lebanon, although we are an ancient people, we're rather new as a country with the borders the French and the British gave us. So over the past 100 years, we've been living under a political system that has been designed by the French and maintained by Western powers, including the United States, and presented as a model for the region. And this political system depends on how we are seen, how we are constructed. So are we seen as individuals, citizens, or as we say in Arabic, people of the land? Or are we seen as sectarian religious communities coexisting together? So we need to keep them safe if they are sectarian religious communities, and we need to keep them represented as sectarian communities. Depending on the narrative you begin with, you end up with a whole different relationship to the country. The narrative of the French, the narrative of the Americans, the narrative of the Canadians, the narrative of Western powers is the idea that we live as religious sectarian communities. This narrative deprives us of citizenship, deprives us of individuality, and creates this false, so to speak, community called a sect. Therefore, incidentally, also depriving us of our religious freedoms. We're no longer individuals. We're no longer workers, teachers, leftists, right-wingers. We're simply members of a sect, members of a sect into which we were born, and that claims to define us. So this narrative takes religions, which should be the way we should be able to worship God, okay, and shifts that relationship into a public identity. So my sect, into which I was born, into which I had no choice, I was born into the sect because my grandfather was born into the sect. This sectarian identity defines all my positions in public office and beyond.
and goes on then to be used as a representation of my political perspective, to which municipality I can be elected, where I can vote, to whatever positions in government I can carry, even to how I can marry and where I can live. All of this is determined by the sect into which I was born. So this political system, which deprives people of citizenship, it does so by offering services rather than rights. It is by design clientelism, and clientelism is simply a softer word for corruption. Sectarian leaders have to maintain a relationship of services with the population. As such, by design, this system becomes corrupt because it is built on clientelism. By design, it deprives people of their social and economic rights, such as decent public education, universal health care, fair housing. So, for example, if we do have universal health care, which, by the way, Shad Ben-Nahas, the head of my political party, Citizens in the State, proposed back when he was Minister of Labour, he came up with a brilliant plan for universal health care that would be financially feasible and would cover each and every Lebanese, regardless of their employment. And it was rejected by all the sectarian political leaders. So if we have universal health care, then we as Lebanese would not need to go begging to the head of the sect to get us access into a hospital. We would not need to go begging for the head of the sect to get us access into a public job. We would get access into public jobs based on our merit, not based on a relationship of favors and services. Okay? So these sectarian political leaders, all of them, no exception, regardless how they want to present themselves, had been working together to ensure that social, economic, and political rights would not be built in the country. So when you have a political system that by design is corrupt, because again, that is what clientelism is, offering services and favors rather than building rights and obligations. This is the definition of corruption. So by design, it is corrupt. It therefore appoints people to fulfill favors rather than based on merit. It therefore does not build national institutions, but rather builds separate powers for each perceived sect. Therefore, it is only natural that it would reach the stage of extreme incompetence. It would reach the stage of refusal of responsibility. It would reach the stage that the president would say that he does not have responsibility over the port. It would reach the stage where thousands of ammonium nitrate would be improperly stored for more than 6 years at a port. In addition to all this, the system breeds the status quo. It builds the status quo. Creates the inability to make a decision. So the official public position in Lebanon is that the government does not have a public position. We don't have a position on Syria, we don't have a position on Iraq, we don't have a position because that would upset what is perceived as these individual sects, and more specifically, it would upset the foreign countries to which they are all held hostage. So imagine a country whose official position is that we refrain from taking a public position. Domestically, it's the same thing. We know that a slew of individuals knew about the ammonium nitrate. They participated by sending letters informing each other, thereby dismissing responsibility and placing it on, someone else. On top of all this, now we have information that the U.S. government and the French government, the Saudi government and the Iranian government are all coming together to figure out what kind of system Lebanon should have. And none of them are talking about the absurdity of this. What legitimacy do they have to determine what our prime minister should do and who he should be? The American government thinks our prime minister should be neutral. Imagine this language. You want the prime minister of a country to be neutral. What does neutrality even mean in a region besieged by occupation, wars, and foreign infiltration? What does that actually mean? You have the other set of foreign infiltrators asking for the return of the previous prime minister, Saad al-Hariri, who submitted a resignation last year amid the protest. And that's it. These are our choices. So these foreign powers now will get to determine who our prime minister is in Lebanon, depending on what political motivations they want. And meanwhile, this same destructive, corrupt, deeply problematic system will be maintained. So we have just another form of colonialism. And because of the growing sense of despair in Lebanon, we have been living and accepting crumbs from foreigners for so long that many in the country can't imagine a real national liberation. So they simply go from one country to the next asking for assistance. The assistance that the U.S. government right now is talking about is really apparent. Members of the Trump administration say, let's take advantage of the situation in Lebanon to maximize pressure on Hezbollah. And the only reason the U.S. government is against Hezbollah, by the way, is not because it's a religious political party, not because it is part of the sectarian political system, but because Hezbollah has proved that it has the military power to stand in front of Israel and to defend Lebanon, and it ends there. But of course, they throw in the magic word corruption. But again, by design, the sectarian political system is corrupt. This entire political system is corrupt. And those foreign, you know, countries, they want the corruption. Here I'm talking about the US government and the French government and others. And let us keep in mind that this sectarian political system is the model that is being used, you know, being taken by the United States to be used in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya. This model that deprives us of citizenship and creates these false, divisive, destructive narratives that end up with this level of incompetence and this level of inability to make decisions, and therefore opens up the domestic scene even more for foreign involvement. Okay. Now, in Lebanon, on top of the bankruptcy, on top of the destruction, on top of the infrastructural loss from this explosion that amounts to more than $15 billion, on top of all this, the U.S. Trump administration is openly talking about further sanctions on Lebanon. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, all the sectarian political leaders are still working to maintain the same political system. And here becomes our responsibility as oppositional political parties, as people who recognize this country for what it is, it becomes our responsibility to actually come up with a new alternative, an alternative that is different from this sectarian political model. And we have been doing so, and we are organizing to build this new political alternative, one that actually would allow this country to finally become a civil, secular state.
I mean, it's very clear that imperial aggression has always been at the center of the foreign policies of these countries that you just mentioned, which in turn has shaped the nations in the Middle East and the internal politics of various countries in the region. And we know that this specific disaster will be yet another opportunity for foreign intervention. And we're seeing this kind of foreign intervention already with Macron's visit, various imperialist powers that are, you know, trying to decide what the political future of the country will be. And also foreign capital and investors that will want to capitalize on this disaster. And perhaps it is difficult to predict at this point the degree to what this foreign intervention is going to look like. But I'm just curious about what your thoughts about foreign intervention are and what you foresee to be some of the dangers that may come along with possible foreign intervention.
Yeah, I just want to say a few things about, you know, the international aid before I talk about foreign intervention up front. I mean, when you think about thus far, $300 million has been pledged. Now, $300 million, you know, it sounds a lot. Oh, my God, hundreds of millions of dollars. But let's put that number into perspective. One, we need $15 billion for reconstruction. So we need $15 billion. We got $300 million. Let me give you another comparison. When the Notre Dame in Paris was burnt, France received $1 billion in aid to rebuild Notre Dame. Okay, when Feldman, under President George Bush, was interfering in Lebanese elections several elections ago, the U.S. poured into Lebanon to interfere in our elections $600 million. Okay, so here already we see the priorities given. Okay, they're clear. So the United States has barely contributed any amount of money within that $300 million. And again, that $300 million by all of these countries so far pledged is less than half the amount that the U.S. government spent in interfering in Lebanon's elections several elections ago. So the international aid is quite offensive in the amount of, in you know, they're spending pennies on us, and they want us to be grateful and appreciative of those pennies. At the same time, when we look at foreign intervention, regardless of the country, every single country intervenes in other countries for the benefit of its own national interest and not for the good of the country in which it is intervening. This is basic understanding. You know, people support each other, but governments support what they consider to be their own interest. And France and the United States are definitely no exception. France is trying to increase its influence in the region. That's why President Emmanuel Macron came immediately to Lebanon. you know, he also wants to increase his popularity within France, because we've seen that decline very strongly, particularly because of the Gilets Jaunes and because of his right-wing policies within France. So he came here to both extend his influence in the region and to increase his own national popularity. By extending his influence in the region, he wants to be stronger than the US. And so that's why he's been leading these so-called international aid efforts. But at the same time, they're still very openly, France and the United States and Iran are very openly interfering in governmental selection in Lebanon. And so then the question becomes, who do they want to lead the country forward in Lebanon? Okay, they're not looking for somebody with an economic vision of equality. They're not looking for somebody with a social vision of equality. They're definitely not looking for somebody with a defensive strategy against our enemy. They're looking for individuals who will be able to support their interest in Lebanon. So then the question is, what are their interests? And their interest as Western powers, as imperialist powers, the US more than France. France wants to be imperialist, but it hasn't really reached that level in the, you know, recently. What they want to do is extend their control over natural resources and very much continue to support their ally, which is the Zionist state of Israel. Okay. So then these would be the individuals that they would bring up. Individuals that within Lebanon, for example, would be supporting further privatization of what remains of our natural resources. You know, would be supporting transforming our army even further into a police force rather than into an army, and working to disarm Hezbollah so that we no longer have a resistance that is powerful in the face of Israel. This is what the French and the Americans want. And then when the Iranians interfere, now we're talking about a compromise. But who is not at the negotiating table are the people of Lebanon themselves, and what it is that we want, and what it is that we aspire to, and the vision that we have for a country. You know, so we're still struggling with that very much so. Fortunately, there are political parties in this country that are oppositional political parties that believe in the need to develop a civil state, that believe in the separation of religion from public office and from public policy. And we have been organizing for years, and we're getting together more and more to build a political alliance and to build a political front, to be able to show that we are the political alternative. Because so long as we maintain this political sectarian system, we will simply have other tragedies and other catastrophes and other bankruptcies and other destructions.
Can you actually elaborate on that further, specifically on the political alternatives that are being visioned, either by political parties, oppositional political parties, or progressives that want to see a democratic, non-sectarian state? And also, can you speak more about the work that is being done to actualize this sort of political vision into reality in Lebanon?
Well, if we recognize that the system is ultimately responsible, and therefore we need to work to dismantle the sectarian political system, if we recognize that that is the problem, therefore we know what we don't want and we know what we do want. We do not want early elections, because early elections, and elections by all the time, are basically controlled by those that write the electoral law and by those that determine the electoral districts. And so we know that elections would simply be a theater like they were in 2018. And give or take a few seats, the same political parties would come to office and maintain the same system. So we definitely don't want early elections, as some have called for. Okay, we do not want foreign interference, because, of course, that's going to push for their own agenda. So what we are calling for, and we had this previously in Lebanon, so it is constitutional, what we are calling for is an interim government with legislative powers. An interim government with legislative powers would basically mean that we hold negotiations with the six sectarian leaders that are the real rulers of this country, not political parties, not all this hogwash. What actually, who really rules the country are six political leaders, six sectarian political leaders. And we need those individuals to understand that this system will continue to bring us death and destruction, and will also weaken their own standing in the country, because all of them, without exception, are weaker today than they were before the bankruptcy. And some of them, particularly, are much weaker after the explosion than they were before. And that weakness threatens them not existentially, but actually literally. So our proposal is an interim government with legislative powers to take over the country for 18 months. And we would then, and we have a very clear economic vision about this, we would then secure, you know, try to build up our economy to transform it from consumptive to productive. We would actually send representatives of the country and not representatives of political parties to renegotiate with all the countries around the world, renegotiate our loans, renegotiate financial agreements and financial transactions. Okay, all the while, of course, recognizing clearly that Israel is an enemy and therefore we do not negotiate with the enemy. Okay, so we're dealing with negotiations with the outside and understanding of what actually, what is the financial status in Lebanon. If you can imagine, we haven't had a financial audit. Imagine, we're bankrupt, but we haven't had a financial audit in Lebanon. Okay, and then we start making sure that the vulnerable in this country are protected. Because so far, yes, the country is broken economically, but there's no government to protect the poor. So what is protecting the poor actually means? It means providing universal health care. It means making sure that every individual in Lebanon, be they a citizen or a resident, actually get decent public education. And providing education for the residents, by the way, we're not only doing that out of the goodness of our hearts, but it's for the goodness of the country. We have hundreds of thousands of foreign workers. We have hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees. And we have more than 1 million displaced Syrians. We cannot simply ignore their presence in our society and say we are not responsible for your welfare and expect that not to have an impact on the entire country. So we call for universal health care. We call for decent public education. We can, through a system of proper taxation, actually make housing affordable. We consider housing to be a right. That doesn't mean ownership is a right, but housing is a right. So we are able to redistribute the losses in such a way as to lessen the burden on the poor. And then we will work on transforming our economy, building sectors that are actually productive in the country. So there will be entire shifts in our economy from those that are currently working in sectors that are no longer sustainable. And we need to move them into sectors that we need to be building, our agricultural sector, our IT sector, other industrial sectors, so on and so forth. We would also be shifting our social laws, because currently most of the laws that impact us as individuals are sectarian laws. But we need to have a unity. We need to build equality. We need to build citizenship. So we would be doing that through the laws of inheritance, child custody, marriage, so on and so forth. At the end of 18 months, we would then develop an electoral law that is truly representative of our country without alienating anyone. Those that wish to continue to be sectarian can, and those that actually want to be represented by the state directly can. And at the end of 18 months, we will have parliamentary and municipal elections, and whoever wins will then go into parliament, and of course then the parliament will re-elect a government, will reappoint a government. That is our plan. That plan, we as a party, Citizens in a State, we announced this plan back in November. And now this is the plan that community organizers and political parties, you know, pretty much all of them have adopted. Okay, that this now is the main rallying cry of the organizers in the streets, the protesters in terms of organizers, and the opposition political parties from the right to the left. Okay, we're hoping that by building then a clear alliance, by showing the unity of this, because of course it's not enough to simply say I support X, we need to be able to work together, that we can be able to build a political front. And we can be able then to have pressure put on the sectarian leaders ourselves to get them to the negotiating table so that we can build a pathway forward.
While this sounds incredibly promising, on the other hand, I'm just wondering, what are the challenges or what kinds of opposition would those working for such a political vision face or encounter? Especially given that this vision calls for the restructuring of the current political system, in many ways dismantling it, and would therefore undermine those that have benefited tremendously from being in power in Lebanon. And so, what are some of the challenges that you foresee?
Well, I mean, I'm not listing this in order of priority or in order of strength, but just as it comes to my mind. But one of the first challenges I would think about would be foreign interference. you know, the US governments, the French governments, Western powers, they typically like to have governments that are not representative. They're threatened by real democracy. They want to have governments that they can control and that they can subjugate. And that is not the government that we envision. So I would imagine that our first challenge would be to try to liberate ourselves from the yoke of foreign interference. And we're seeing how the French and Americans are grossly interfering, as are the Iranians and Saudis and the Turks, by the way. That is one challenge. Another challenge, organizer to organizer, it is always difficult to take visions and to translate them to real work on the ground. And this is what we've been trying to do since October, to try to build this alliance among organizers, to try to have people understand really what politics is all about, that we don't want to be demanding statements from a government and from a political system that we know is unable to fulfill those demands. And by making demands on them, we grant them political legitimacy. So just trying to shift that political understanding from organizers, we've been able to somewhat. And now, because of this explosion, the level of urgency amongst the organizers has dramatically increased, and it has opened up a possibility for us to be able to organize more effectively. There is the third challenge, of course, which is the sectarian leaders themselves. Are they rational enough? I'm not saying are they kind enough. Are they rational enough to understand that our proposal will actually save them? Because if they continue on this path, one of the possibilities, one of the scenarios that could arise is civil violence. And civil violence would be destructive to everybody. Another scenario that could arise is one of these political sectarian leaders could lose more than they currently lose. Are they willing to take that risk? Because it is a big risk, you know. So we are hoping that they would still have a shred of rationality left in them to understand that our proposal actually is the real savior of the country, and the country includes them. These political sectarian leaders are not foreigners that are occupying our lands. They're still of our people. And as much as we disagree with them politically, you know, we do not have the political power to be demanding their execution. We are trying to build the political power to actually be working our way forward in unity and in construction. There is also a mistaken narrative that sometimes has been propped up by the West and sometimes has been propped up by those who are very fearful of imperialism, which is that by bringing up all the sectarian leaders, I am including Hezbollah. So can we be open to criticize a political party in Lebanon that, yes, did give us the resistance, did give us liberation, you know, did prove itself to be a brilliant defensive strategy against, you know, against the enemy, but at the same time, domestically, is deeply problematic? Can we be able to build a narrative that is that nuanced, that is not so black and white? We, my political party and others with whom we are aligning, know very clearly that any call today to ask for the disarmament of Hezbollah would be standing and making Lebanon defenseless. And we refuse to do that. So we are asking for political negotiations with all parties. Our vision is that ultimately we do want an army that would be strong enough to protect all our lands, all our skies, all our seas. Ultimately, in that process, we want to be negotiating for disarmament. But through that process, not out of a vision that looks for neutrality and that looks for surrender with an enemy that is an existential threat to Lebanon, which is what the apartheid state of Israel is, nor out of a sense of fear that, oh, Hezbollah is a threat to us in the country, which it isn't. So, you know, we're not from one reason or the other, but rather because defense of the country is a privilege that we all should carry on our shoulders. And that the real way to defend our country is through our national institutions. Because we need to be building that understanding across all our institutions. We need to be strong domestically for us to be able to fight the wars that we need to fight internationally. You know, and when I'm saying internationally, I mean specifically across our border with Israel, okay? So we need that understanding. How clear can we build that understanding in our narratives so that people across the political spectrums understand and it's not transformed into this black and white binary presentation?
thanks so much for sharing this very comprehensive vision of what needs to be done, and also the challenges that you've outlined that, of course, will have to be politically maneuvered and negotiated. On the one hand, the task ahead seems quite remarkable with all of the levels of work that will need to be done. And on the other, it's also quite frightening knowing that a dramatic shift of a political system or dismantlement of that will be, of course, met with quite a lot of violence. And so, yeah, but as we're talking about change or thinking about change, I also just want to go back to the October uprisings you brought up, or, you know, what some have called the October Revolution. I'm just wondering, how are the post-disaster or the post-explosion protests that we're seeing right now distinct from the October uprisings or revolution?
No, no, the big difference between the uprising in October, and I like to use my words accurately, so I don't call it a revolution, because a revolution means we're united for something. An uprising means we're united against something. And what happened in October was definitely an uprising and not a revolution. But the main difference for us as organizers on the street between the October protest and the protest over this past week is the space for hope. So in October, the level of outrage was much lower than it is now, and the space for hope was much higher. And when hope becomes really high, the level of urgency becomes lower. Now the level of outrage is much higher. The space for hope is much lower, thereby the level of urgency gets to be much higher, which allows those of us who have been organizing to demand political clarity from all the other organizers, it actually gives us a space now. Because previously there were calls, let's just unite, let's just come together. And what we would say is, come together under what umbrella? You know, for what vision? It's not enough to just unify. What does unify mean? I mean, unify reminds me of the Democratic Party in the United States. Just come together and vote Democrat. That, just come together and vote Democrat. And then you end up with, you know, the top cop being appointed as vice president-elect, disputing weeks and weeks of protest against police brutality. Just to give you, you know, one example. So political clarity is always, always, always necessary and can never be sacrificed. Now, because we as a political party, citizens in a state, have been adamant in our vision since November, that vision has really reached across. And now when we are calling for political clarity, because the level of urgency is way, way higher, people are responding. I wish people responded as effectively back in October, but nevertheless, people are responding. That is the main difference that I see. Of course, we can talk about size, we can talk about, you know, demographics, et cetera, but this really, really is the main difference. The level of violence extended against the protesters has also increased, and it's much higher now than it was in October. Now Beirut is in a state of emergency, which means that we're under military rule, so to speak. So the level of violence that the military can engage in becomes also much higher. The level of organizing that we can do, you know, under the state of emergency becomes much lower. But nevertheless, we're still doing it because the outrage is so high, because we've seen our city decimated, not as an act of war, you know, not as an act of a natural hurricane, but purely out of negligence. And the negligence is also born not simply from the corruption that's systematic within the system, but also this sense that our lives are disposable, that the people in charge are not really thinking of us as people, but the whole time they're thinking of us as pawns, as, you know, items or commodities or speculations. So that is why the level of outrage is really so high. But again, speaking from one organizer to another, what is always necessary when outrage is high is for it to be enveloped under a practical, political, self-aware program and organizing. I also just want to say one thing, if you'd allow me. You know, a lot of people in the West have been asking how they can support and how they can support. And I think, to me, the first responsibility for people in Canada and people in the United States in particular is to try to work to liberate this region from foreign intervention. And right now there have been a lot of calls coming from the New York Times, coming from others, and Canada unfortunately has been following in the footsteps of US imperialism in the region, not standing as a protector of the little guy in any way, shape or form, neither in Canada nor overseas. So we have to be very careful. You know, the calls for increased sanctions on Lebanese, these are very detrimental, let alone unethical calls, but they're very detrimental calls that will have huge impacts on the Lebanese economy. The previous, you know, the Trump administration CSAR Act, that the sanctions that they have been imposing against Syria are also extremely detrimental, not only criminal and unethical, but also detrimental not only to Syria, but of course to Lebanon. So solidarity goes beyond simply giving us aid, which is necessary and we need it. Solidarity also has to come from a real sense of liberation and a real sense of questioning, you know, your government's foreign intervention and understanding what sanctions mean and how sanctions for decades now have unfortunately become a, quote, tool of diplomacy. But sanctions are basically another form of economic terrorism.
Indeed. Your insights here on solidarity are very crucial, particularly at a time when many are trying to organize in solidarity with Lebanon, be it the Lebanese diaspora communities or leftists or progressives. And I think, you know, it's necessary for people to be thinking very carefully about solidarity and to ensure that solidarity isn't co-opted to meet the agendas of imperialist powers and their aid regimes, and rather that the solidarity that is enacted considers the ways in which various sorts of policies reinscribe and reproduce power. And so that those policies need to be thought through when thinking about solidarity, especially for those that are located in the West. So thank you for that, because clarity for political organizing is specifically needed now more than ever. And it's a reminder that good intentions are not always good enough, and sometimes good intentions can be very dangerous. And so I think also this ask of solidarity in a very critical way is really important. I want to move to the next question, which is concerning, education. You are an educator and a prominent organizer in Beirut. And I'm just wondering what forms of popular education or approaches you use to organize and mobilize young people to do this work that you've just talked about.
One of the difficulties that we face, and this isn't just limited to Lebanon, but it might be found across communities that have been colonized for so long, is that our imagination becomes limited. And we cannot imagine another system. We cannot imagine another way of life. So when I come up with a proposal, when my political party comes up with a proposal, a lot of people respond by saying that this is unrealistic, that it's not pragmatic, that we need to be more grounded, okay? So basically that becomes, we need to accept crumbs, and maybe if we demand a little bit more crumbs, maybe that'll be okay, you know? And this I find to be deeply, deeply problematic. I remember, you know, one question I asked my students several years ago, I asked them, I said, now you are in charge of the country. You can do anything, absolutely anything. What would you do? And their answers were so small. They came up with recycling programs. I mean, really, really so small. And I think what we have to do as educators is re-empower imagination and think about really what we want, really what it is that we want to build, and not be limited by this constricting question of what is possible. Because we first have to know what we want, and then we will ask ourselves, okay, how can we get there? And then we develop and understand the possible. But if all we do is think about what is possible, and we allow the narrative of the oppressor to even tell us what is possible, then what choices will I actually be living my life to build? What really am I working for? A choice between Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola? A choice between Donald Trump and Joe Biden? These are the choices that we would end up with? But we have to be able to think big as educators and to really assist our students, assist our community to liberate ourselves from these very destructive, divisive, and false narratives. The narratives are actually false. We have done so much in this country already. We were able as people to liberate Beirut from the Israeli occupation. We were able as people to liberate the South from Israeli occupation. We were able to do that. And I'm sure that there were many people in Lebanon that thought it would not be possible. It simply would not be possible. You know, my grandfather fought against the French occupation. He almost died to liberate this country from the French occupation because he believed it was necessary. I don't think he ever asked, was it possible? He believed it was necessary. So let us reevaluate how we organize and what possibilities we allow ourselves. And let us reevaluate another question that I get all the time from students and from people on the ground when I'm organizing, which also is a very problematic question, where I'm asked, you know, do I have hope? And what is the probability of the success of this project? Okay. And I tell them, I'm not a gambler. I don't play poker. And if I were a gambler or I played poker, then I would talk about probabilities. And if I were a spectator at a football game, then I would talk about hope. What is the hope that the Brazilian team can beat the German 7-1 instead of being beaten by the German 7-1? Those would be questions that I would accept in those aspects. But if I accept that I am not a spectator in my own country, and I am not simply watching a scene unfold in front of me, then the question becomes, how can I build the hope? How can I be the change? How can I actually be part of a movement that would make the hope revolutionary and contagious? Not what is the percentage of hope that is present. But since I consider myself to be responsible for my community, responsible for my people, responsible for the liberation of my country, therefore I should never accept defeat simply because there is no hope. I should try to say, how can I build it? And this applies everywhere. This applies in the United States, this applies in Canada, it applies everywhere. How can we as organizers, as, you know, liberators in the full sense of the word, work to build hope and work to think on the short term, the medium term, and the long term throughout, and never, never, never accept defeat simply because the probability is of success is low. You know, again, that would be accepting an oppressive narrative.
Well, Rania, I want to close with a question on the imaginary, since you just mentioned it in especially your last response, is what is your vision of liberation for Lebanon and the region more broadly?
You know, whenever I think about it, I'm able to breathe again. So my vision is that we've developed our civil state. We've restored religion to its rightful place as a personal relationship between ourselves and who we choose to worship. And we've built an economy that is ecologically honest, that is productive, that is both humble and sustainable. We've built equality among all our men and women. And we've respected those who are not citizens in our country, respected them through our labor laws, through our social laws, you know, and done all of this and become contagious. We have reverberated across the region. So Syrians, Iraqis, Jordanians then look at and go, oh, this is the state that we want to build. This is the democracy that we want to build. And we would become so contagious and so powerful in this vision of egalitarian democracy and real liberation that we would then be able to liberate the heart of the region, the beating heart of the region, which is the occupied lands of Palestine. That is ultimately my dream. You know, and there can be no real stability. There can be no real sense of dignity in this region, so long as the very heart of this region, which is Palestine, remains occupied, remains dispossessed, so long as apartheid remains present and apartheid remains contagious, because we see what the Israeli state is doing with its influence in India and with its support of the occupation and dispossession in Kashmir. We see what they have done to numerous countries in Africa. We've seen their reverberations. Just as, you know, this level of ugliness, of apartheid, of fascism is contagious, Let us, those who believe in another world, let our building also be contagious. Let us think about a way that we can liberate our countries in such a way that we are no longer given the binary of under whose shadow should we be? Should we align with the United States or should we align with China? But that we would actually be aligning with those who are just and those who are true and those who are really egalitarian and those who are really dignified. That is my dream. Whether I will get to see that in my lifetime, I do not know. But I just hope to whoever, pray to whoever is out there that I will continue to have the privilege to fight in the struggle.
Thank you, Rania, for your critical insights and the important political and intellectual work you're doing for your hopeful imaginaries and for being with us amidst being super busy organizing in this moment. Sending so much solidarity and revolutionary rage from Toronto. Shukran Ektir.
Tislami. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.